Welcome back our audience here to Tech Conversations, now in season 5, and we're doing some follow-ups, and I'm excited again to connect with Amanda Lotz. She needs no introduction, but we will introduce her. This is her third conversation with us here, and we don't know how to piece the streaming world or the media universe together, but she can help us go through a couple of things today. Want to introduce her as an educator, an author, and also a media consultant. Welcome, Amanda.
Thank you very much for having me again.
Thank you for joining us. So let's kick it off. You know, one of the biggest things I think that's happening is that we see the collapse of these cable bundles and linear viewing. Let's start there.
Sure. So very much in the news today, but I think we have to recognize that this has been a long, 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 long time coming, right? And I think for folks who are listening who are American consumers, you know, I think looking back to how you feel about your cable company, if you still have one, or how you felt about them, let's say in the early 2000s, is a real good explainer for how we got here. There are probably are few sectors that have been more reviled than cable was for the early century. And I think while often our ire was directed at companies like Comcast, Charter, Cox, those people we were paying our bills to, what we didn't realize was that the regular price hikes that we were seeing were being driven by the content companies and the ability of the content companies to negotiate off of the back of some piece of content or some channel that the cable providers had to have. And so if you look at we had incredible growth in new series on cable in the early 2000s, which for some of us was great. It was a great period of storytelling in American culture, but many people who weren't watching those shows paid for it. Many people who aren't big sports fans have been paying outrageous fees to subsidize ESPN. And all of that happened because of market failure. And this was market failure that regulators allowed to happen. And so again, if you remember the dynamic there, you didn't have much of choice. Like there was one cable provider for your area. Yes, you could get satellite instead, but the way in which the content companies had structured their deals prevented satellite from offering a different rate for the channels, which meant that cable and satellite basically cost the same. So it really sort of quashed that ability to create a competitive environment. And so when I say in a market failure, you had this environment in which consumers had no recourse to the steadily increasing fees. There was not a way to say, I want this and not that. It was either all the cable and its escalating price or none of the cable. And the key beneficiaries of those ever escalating cable prices were actually the content conglomerates more than the cable companies. And now that we have choice, now that you could choose to have a streaming service instead of cable or some of these other providers that are bringing costs down a little bit, there is more choice in the market and people have finally begun to move away from these cable packages. And the consequence again is for the content providers because they have grown fat on the revenue that was coming in through those systems.
So I have a question for you because in cable, I think people felt hostage, whether you were a consumer or whether you were a content provider. The consumer was stuck. You had, like you said, people paying all these fees. And for example, I'm not a huge sports fan. So why do I have to have the whole ESPN thing? But my husband is a sports fan, right? So the content companies also felt hostage. You saw those blackouts that used to happen where they would tell the consumers to call the 1-800 number to get back on their tiers because they were negotiating. So the streaming war sort of ended that hostage situation, or did it really? I mean, like, put some context into it.
Yeah, and I think we're having one of those moments right now, right? So obviously it didn't end them because not, I think we also have to think about how cable whether you are a single person in your own apartment for the first time, or you are a family of six in a big sprawling suburban house, cable costs the same, right? That doesn't make a ton of sense. And, you know, sort of the value of that cable subscription is going to vary significantly, whether if you're just one person and these streaming services come along and they offer you a way to just get the one thing you want, then that's really handy. But cable has continued to be very heavily subscribed because it does make sense for households with lots of people with different tastes and preferences. So he said, it's funny, I've been researching this stuff for long enough. Thinking back, certainly by, let's say, 2010, there is this loud in the trade press and among journalists, you know, cable cutting's coming, cord cutting's coming, people are going over the top, right? But actually, it didn't happen for, you know, like, you watch the numbers and like this, you know, apocalypse was being predicted, but it didn't really start to transpire until about 2018. And since then, the, you know, sort of, I think the scale of cable cutting that was expected by many to happen around 2010 started happening about a decade later. And, you know, I don't know if some people started to think that it was never going to happen. I think we both follow Evan Shapiro, another analyst, and he was just on LinkedIn saying, you know, cable's not dying. Yep. And that's true. But it is the case that cable's underlying economics are going to have to respond to market conditions. Like, these are people voting with their feet. They don't want these big packages. And to your point there, you know, so the place that I blame the content creators is the nature of the deals that they would make. And we're even seeing them here, you know, from what I can gather of what's happening with Charter and Disney. And like, so it's not just, you know, negotiating for a certain amount of money for each channel. Like, you could arguably make the case that those channels are worth certain amounts of money to consumers, but it's the content creators have created the giant bundles, right? So we're seeing Charter cable providers for a long time now have been asking to move ESPN into a sports tier, and Disney won't let them, right? And so those kind of decisions, the way in which the requirement to have major channels in the basic tier bundle where they have the most subscribers, so they're going to be getting the most money, and not giving consumers an ability to actually have a variety of products to choose from, that is impeding the natural logics of the market. And the consequence is, you know, you chase it down, you know, why? The amount of money that ESPN has been able to generate has, you know, then feeds, you know, giant salaries in the sports leagues and those licenses are long term. And so, you know, I many of these businesses are in a really tough spot because they have committed to spending for, you know, an ongoing horizon. But at the we talk a lot, or every time I talk to a journalist, they want to know, how many streaming services will we subscribe to? Okay. That's always the question. Like, aren't there too many? And there's a lot of attention to that consumer price point, but somehow we don't talk about the way in which consumers are getting such diminished value in the cable environment and what is driving costs there. And I think that has to be part of this conversation just as well.
Yeah, no, completely agree. I feel like even after listening to this analysis, I still feel that the consumer, to some extent, is being held hostage. Like, we're still in sort
we have
of
a lot more choice, right?
Yeah,
like if you think about the way that, like, subscribing to cable, like, you couldn't come in and out, right? Like, so if you're price sensitive, you can come in and out of cable streaming services pretty easily. If you really want to be, you know, you could jump from one to one month to month. So there are more ways, there's much more flexibility for consumers. It is, if you don't want to have an active life in managing your subscriptions, then, you know, you do end up paying for a lot. But I also think it's the case that we don't, the sense of timeliness that used to be so core to television is starting to fade a little bit. So just because there's a new show on Disney Plus doesn't mean you need to be watching it right now, right? You can, in our house, we get Disney Plus over Christmas. You know, like we have a cycle. So I think there it is frustrating for consumers, but you know, I think just think back to the early 2000s and how frustrating things were. And in the US, the way in which your internet service is tied up in that. And so, you know, those are giant bills. And those are bills that people in other countries don't see because they have competition. And there's been, there are several analysts that I follow who, you know, as the government started looking at the tech industry and seemed to perhaps be doing something in a regulatory vein there, you know, many of them were saying, hey, you know, like, look at our cable providers, look at our internet providers, if you really want to see some abuses, you know, and they're not wrong. You know, that too is an industry where we don't have the kind of competition that would create reasonable pricing. And yeah, that's part of the reason now that Charter can take the position that they are and sort of say, hey, we make most of our money from the internet. We don't need your Disney channels.
Yeah, I guess the whole dynamic has changed. So moving the conversation forward, how does this whole, you know, the whole situation with the writers and everything come into play? Let's go there.
Yeah. Well, these are businesses, you know, you think about those ledgers, you know, money comes in, money goes out. And you know, I think the timing for the strikes and these contracts coming due was unfortunate because, you know, there are reasonable arguments, quote unquote, on both sides. It is the case that the entertainment sector is facing existential business redevelopment. I mean, if we're on, and like the money that they have been getting from cable, the billions of dollars, that's actually not going to be what they're available to them anymore. The amount of money that they made through the late 90s and the first, let's say, 15 years of the 2000s, they were making more money than they should have. And so I think you've got a whole generation that kind of thought that was normal. But it's not. And so you have all kinds of pressures, even though the conglomerates, let's say Disney, may be showing billions of profits. If you actually look at the investor reports, those profits aren't coming from film and television. They're mostly coming from the parks, to some degree from these cable deals that are now in stress, right? Like, so the idea that they're making all this money in the businesses that we're talking about in terms of the writers and actors is not actually the case. So you have these streaming enterprises that are losing tons of money. And that's to be expected. We're in a moment of transition. They're trying to figure out what the new business is. They have not gotten there yet. I think Netflix, partly because it doesn't have the pull of a legacy business, Netflix has been better positioned and sort of knows what it's doing. Where I think the stream or the studio-based streamers, Disney, Paramount Plus, Max, they haven't actually embraced how radical this new world is. They haven't figured out that it's really difficult to do both ad support and subscriber support at the same time. Are they trying to get everyone or some of the people? Are they putting enough money and development into their interfaces and their search in order to help people actually find the content that is interesting on their services? So they have not figured out those businesses yet. And sort of Wall Street is arguably unreasonably impatient. You know, we need corporate leaders who feel that they have 5 years to get this sorted out. And that's not what we've had. So you have the studios in a really tough position in terms of committing, you know, going forward, because they know that the nature of these businesses are going to change and they're arguably going to be smaller in the US. I think that's another piece that we often don't recognize, but you know, when you have services like Netflix that are making content around the world, and you have Americans actually watching content from around the world, which is a good thing. Historically, the U.S. has really dominated global trade for reasons that aren't, let's say, socially healthy. But the consequence of that is that, you know, you have more writers working in other places, and we don't necessarily have more money to support more content. So I think to some degree, the sort of peak TV thing gets thrown around. And I think it's too simple to sort of say, well, that was dumb and they should have known better. We were in a moment. And where we the needs were building these catalogs. But the mistake was assuming that that level of production was going to be constant, or that that was we were on a path of never ending and continued growth. And so the consequence, and I think what we'll continue to figure out now, given that we're going to have a period of not a lot of new production, is that there is too much content out there in terms of to consume in a given week. And that actually, now that we have services that give us an experience that allow us to find things later, we may find that we don't need the quantity of production that we have had. And again, that's something that has big implications for people whose livelihood is based on making that content.
Yeah, I'm glad you brought that up because, you go to the different services, and with the exception of the originals that they have on each service, everything else in terms of, be movies or series that have already run, like the Suits now being like this whole popular explosion, like Manifest finding a new life after it was, canceled on NBC. The content is really the same across a lot of different services. So really what I feel that the consumer, the subscriber, is really signing up for more than anything is the originals that they are bringing to the table. Is that an accurate assumption?
I think every consumer is a little bit different in terms of what they have and haven't watched, right? And so, you know, we were really having reasonable conversations about peak TV from about, let's say, in 2012 was just when the streamer started producing. But even by 2012, you had cable channels doing a lot of good shows. Suits is a good example that, you know, if you're a regular broadcast watcher, maybe you had no idea that that show existed, right? And so we've gotten to the point now where we have had over a decade of overproduction, and so of shows that people just didn't hear about the first time around. And so for a consumer, you know, do I care that Suits is an original or not? It's new to me, right? And so I think the idea that a lot of those catalogs are new to people, but I think the other thing that people are paying for, and we forget this, we're paying for an experience. We're paying for that ability to watch a catalog worth of programming whenever we want. To start it and stop it when we want, in some cases to watch it without advertising, to not have to wait a week for the next episode, to not have to wait, you know, year, 6 months between sets of episodes, right? And so part of what consumers are paying for, and I think again, for consumers, if we think back to what that experience is to not be able to watch in that way, the fees that we pay these services become more reasonable when we recognize that experience is part of what we're paying for. And that other experience, you know, we thought of that content as free, but we were paying with our time, we were paying with our attention. And if you come out of that world, then you pay with your money.
Yeah. So I think that's a great segue into the conversation about the ad tiers for Netflix, Disney Plus, because last year when you and I spoke, this was being talked about and the password crackdown was going on. But I feel like Netflix in particular has still managed to report gains, even though they came up with this password crackdown. So let's break it down for our listeners.
Yeah, and I think we're still in pretty early days, you know. So, of course, like there's a growth in their ad of the number of subscribers they have on the ad funded tiers. But of course, if you're starting from a base of zero, it's really easy to have big growth. I think the bigger shots across the bow to consumers have been things like Netflix cancel eliminating their lowest price tier. I think that's clearly an effort to get those people either into the a blended tier where they're getting ads, and so they're getting ad revenue that way, or to push them into the higher subscriber funded tier. I think honestly, if we look at these businesses, they probably need to be have they need to be charging more than they are. And the reality is that there will be fewer of them because consumers can't pay for a bunch of them at a higher rate. And so I think that's, in my mind, that's what we're going to see in the next 3 to 5 years is sort of the separation of those who will make it and those who won't, or those will have three combined into one. We'll see. But so the emergence of these ad tiers are interesting, and I'm still trying to wrap my head around what that's going to mean. Because at this point, from what I can tell, and Netflix is, classically tight-lipped, they're following more or less the same kind of buying model as television, in that consumer or that companies are able to buy ads in particular content. I don't know whether either that's going to go by the wayside or we're going to have a world in which we have two different ad environments, because that is different than what is happening with FAST channels, which are also very big and buzzy right now. So internet delivered, but linear channels. And in the FAST space and in a lot of the video on demand space, the advertising technology that's being used is programmatic buying. And it's the same kind of model that the web has been based on and social media has been based on for the last decade or so. And in that environment, so if you're watching a FAST channel, then and there's a commercial for Coke, it's not that Coke has bought an ad in that particular year. I'm watching the Nashville channel. Let's say it's not that Coke has bought in the Nashville channel. Coke has bought on Tuesday night. We want a woman in a certain age range in a certain demographic and zip code. And no matter what I'm watching, if it's on a FAST channel, I'm going to see that ad. That's a really different dynamic than the historic model of buying attention in particular content. It makes sense given the on-demand technology. But the big questions that I have are what is that going to mean for the content strategy? And so the thing that as a lover of television and as a person who wants to see a variety of stories being told in culture, the thing that I have loved about streaming services and their subscriber funding is that that is a model that encourages different storytelling. It as opposed to ad funding, it doesn't, it's not about get as many people to watch the same thing at the same time, which then leads creators to make content that everyone will be kind of okay with, right? And so I'm hoping that we don't lose the diversity of storytelling that has happened with these new models. And I guess at this point, it's just sort of a question is how or what are the implications of having services that are relying both on advertisers and subscribers for funding? What is that going to do to their content strategies? Are
Yeah.
they going to chase blockbuster kind of hits, the things that Everyone watches, mind you, of course everyone's been doing that for forever. It's very unpredictable. It's a risky business. Is there still a business to be had in the analogy I've heard around the industry for a while now is that it's now a business of singles and doubles, a baseball metaphor instead of home runs. Those singles and doubles have given us some really important content. Maybe we're not all watching it, but I think a much greater variety of people have been able to see stories that they connect with, and that they truly love, as opposed to just sort of something to pass the time. And when we're in a subscriber model, love is rewarded economically, right? Why do you continue to pay for that service? Well, it has the thing that I love. And maybe, I'm not spending hours and hours, but it gives me something I can't get anywhere else. And I think if we run back to trying to make everybody just kind of satisfied most of the time, that's not going to lead people to continue to support these with subscriptions. And perhaps I think the other thing that's really hard is that we now have a lot of other things competing for our attention. And at the end of the day, something like social media is the business model is going to win. They can sell our attention without paying for the content. That business model is always going to be better than what happens when you are paying millions of dollars to gather the attention and then putting the ad in that. So it's really tough.
I mean, I can say that, as an example, I love to subscribe to Netflix because I like to watch Bridgerton and I like to watch an array of other originals that they have there. And a lot of people feel the same way. They like the instant gratification, and it's also part of the new normal, because the younger generation loves instant gratification. So you want it, now, and I don't want to wait a month or a week like Hallmark does. Hallmark has their tentpoles, but you won't see When Calls the Heart or the new show, The Way Home, for a year, because what they do is that they have their tentpoles, but then they have their seasonality, right? The winter and the spring and the summer and the fall, and then their big holiday. So I feel like if you look at Hallmark, it still works in a way, in a traditional way, if you want to go that route. But if you're, I think, in the younger demos, you're going to be more inclined to be only on streaming because you have it right there. And I don't have to wait to watch Bridgerton next week. And I don't have to wait, to watch the rest of the episodes. I do have to wait for the next season to come up, Bridgerton 3. But at least I can refresh myself if I find myself questioning something from the show, because there are hardcore fans with these shows. They have a huge following, whether it's Netflix or Disney or Hulu. Kardashian's Lefty went to Hulu, and a lot of people migrated that way that follow them. And Hulu is known also, and I believe some of the streaming services do have student discounts. I have heard the younger crowd that sits still, like at FIU or going to any other university, anywhere, that they do offer students a break in the streaming prices. So some of them navigate towards, a Hulu more than anything else.
Yeah, I think
So,
that's makes sense, and that's the getting young people to perceive that as a rite of passage, for me.
yes.
How do I know I'm a grown up? Well, I have an apartment and I pay my own cable bill. So,
Well, I mean, if you
now
think about it, the streaming is still cheaper than the cable, if you think about
oh,
it. Because
tons.
people that I know were paying over $200 or more, and now they're like, oh, I did the cord cutting, and now I'm only paying three services, and it's way less than that. So, as we close this amazing conversation, because I always see this as a lesson for me that I'm such an enthusiast of media, how do we look at, the future? Because the US sector looks like there's a lot of unknowns there, and I want you to kind of conclude with
So, I wish I
that.
had genius knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
I think my strategy has always been to try to understand what is at the root, right? And unfortunately, the nature of a lot of the press coverage and trade coverage at this point, because in many of those journalistic organizations are shells of their former selves, they're not doing that work. They're not putting together that context and actually explaining why this thing is happening. Now, just keep an eye as you're cover as you're reading the coverage of the Disney charter situation. How many, who wants to go back and really explain that the dynamics that brought us here? They're rare. And I think the consequence of that is even folks who are dealing with these things in their day-to-day job don't appreciate the root cause of the problem that they're dealing with. And as long as we continue to try to paper over the symptom instead of the problem at its core, we're just going to continue to be in a cycle of crisis. And so, I think we'll see what happens with the Charter Disney situation, but the fact that we've come this close to actually like breaking down the old way, like there simply is no way around a period in which things are going to get bad in order to start rebuilding these industries. We can just keep kicking it down, but in order to have a sustainable sector going forward, it really is letting go a lot of the past, and that will have big consequences. But we're going to have those consequences either way. It's just sort of on your terms or on someone else's.
So let me ask you, because I get this conversation amongst colleagues all the time. We see the cable, we see the streaming, but where does that really leave, the traditional, the big networks, because all of the networks have streaming services, right?
Yeah.
Where does that leave them? Yeah. Where do we see that going?
So in the US, we have to remember conglomeration, right? And part of why we've been able to like kick the can this far has been conglomeration. It's not that long ago, the 90s, really, they weren't that long ago, but it was the 90s. Before the 90s, cable companies, broadcasters, and studios were all in different businesses. And so in the mid 90s, they all came together and they've been able to kind of move the money around, right? And so that we couldn't see the crisis. Now we can see the crisis. I think when we look, we see people spending more and more time with streaming, and streaming makes a lot of sense for certain kinds of content, but people are still watching broadcast because of specifically news and sports, and news and sports and advertising. Those three things work pretty well. Do we need three or how many, six, how many, do we need that many broadcasters? Is there a sustainable business for that many? Maybe not, right? And so maybe you go from having six unsustainable networks to having two or three that can make a go of it. Maybe those businesses become more local. That's what happened with radio when television came in.
Right.
There's a real absence in the US of local, given what's happened with newspapers.
Yes.
So I think the key is filling gaps rather than having multiple kinds of companies doing the same thing. It sounds really dire and pessimistic, but my concern is following the strike that the broadcasters never come back to comedy and drama. And where I am in Australia, it's already the case that because it's a smaller country and there's less ad dollars around, drama is just not sustainable. You can't get enough attention to cover the cost of production. And I think that will increasingly, in the US, because they've been able to sell that content on and on, it's been all right. But the more and more people get used to going to streaming services for a nightly fix of a comedy or a drama, the harder it's going to be to get that audience back, which is not to say that, people like reality TV. There's a lot of cheaper production that's out there that will gather attention for broadcasters and will work with that smaller audience. But the advertisers are a really important part of this story, and I don't feel like we hear enough from them in terms of what their priorities are and what is the kind of attention they want to buy? What is the kind of attention that they are going to pay a premium for? At this point, I think there's a sense that and I think this is what Netflix and Disney are chasing, that there is a sense that if Netflix and Disney can offer an experience with fewer ads, and still all of the other pieces of a better experience for consumers, that consumer that the kind of consumers that advertisers want to reach will be able to be found there, and that advertisers will pay at rates, not because that's not going to be the cheapest place to buy ads, but that's going to be a good place to buy ads. And I think that's a piece that often gets lost, and especially with the hype of what we've had in terms of social media and digital buying, digital ads for so long. Yes, some advertisers do want targeting. It's great for certain advertisers, and some are driven to spend absolutely the least possible. But that's not the only thing that's valuable to advertisers. Quality of audience, being able to have broad reach, not just putting your ad in front of people who might buy it, but actually building, market awareness with other people. Those are also things that are valuable to some advertisers at some times, and that's what television has delivered. And so I think that those dollars, the advertisers are looking for a place to put that money, and it's decreasingly going to be on broadcast, and it's decreasingly going to be on cable. So I think finding an alternative space as soon as possible is crucial for the services.
I think you're right. I mean, I talk to advertisers a lot. And I think the question that they always have is, A, trying to understand who's really watching. Then they try to understand on the Hispanic multicultural side, they want to learn more about the audiences and how they can engage them. And when it comes to content, I think they just want to know a lot of different information that I think sometimes the streamers in general don't want to give them for various reasons, and or they just don't have the data depending on the on how you manage your service.
And I think the streamers have had a leg to stand on in terms of their position about not sharing data when they were subscriber funded, right? You
Right.
know, the reason why things like Nielsen ratings existed was to create currency for the advertisers. As soon as you start taking on ads, you have to become more
Yeah.
transparent. So I suspect we will see change in that space.
Well, Amanda Lotz, it's always a pleasure to have you here on our podcast. You're welcome to come back anytime. I know I always reach out to you. I'm a huge follower of yours and also Evan Shapiro and quite a lot of other ones. But Amanda's always been somebody who breaks it down in a very, like you said, we have to go to the root to figure out how we got here. And I think you always do a good job of explaining the background that a lot of the different articles and people talking miss. So we thank you for that. And we thank you again for joining the podcast, Amanda.
Thanks, Maggie. I always appreciate your amplifying of my work.
Thank
Thanks so much.
you so much. Have a great one.
Thank you. Take care.
Thank
Bye.
you. Bye-bye.